first case for argument this morning is Davis against Conway Transportation. Mr. Agostino.
May it please the court, counsel. There are three groups of errors that I believe that the district court committed in denying Mr. Davis an opportunity to get to a jury on his employment discrimination claim. I think that the district court erred when it ignored certain evidence that had been presented to it or drew inferences on evidence that was presented in favor of the defendant rather than in favor of Mr. Davis. The court below ignored the effect, the cumulative effect of circumstances taken as a whole relative to the issue of pretext. The court ignored evidence of prior misconduct involving discrimination on the basis that the conduct was not actionable. However, that evidence was relevant to the decision of whether or not Mr. Davis was the subject of retaliation after his second claim of discrimination. And finally, I think as a whole, the decision of the court below, I think, is inconsistent with the decision that would be called for under the analysis under Reeves, where the Supreme Court has held that if you have a prima facie case, which was conceded in this case, was never in dispute, and you have a dispute on pretext, then the case gets to the jury. And I think that the Seventh Circuit has come to the analysis, I think is reflected in the Stone case, that really what the discrimination cases are about, you either have direct evidence or you have circumstantial evidence. The issue boils down to why was the person terminated? If there's a dispute on pretext in an indirect evidence case, then the case should go to a jury, and that's what we have here. Now, if I may point out specifically how I believe the court below erred in terms of evidence that ignored. We had two charges of discrimination filed by Mr. Davis. The first was in 99, the second was in early 2000. And by February, the second charge had been dealt with by the company. The person that responded to that charge was a Mr. Trott. And in his response to that charge, he claimed that Mr. Davis, who had been threatened by a coworker that he would have his black monkey ass beaten until it was white, that somehow did not amount to discriminatory conduct. Now, it's important because shortly after the second charge, on March 15th, a Mr. Pence, who was in the chain of command over Mr. Davis, tells Mr. Davis's supervisors, find a way to fire Henry. And that happens in March. The district court...
Who did he say that to?
He said that to Mr. Patrick, who was in the chain of command at the South Bend office for Conway. And the district court completely ignored that fact. And the basis that the court below decided was that, well, it's outside the 300 days if we look back from the filing of the third charge. And it is outside the 300 days. However, it is relevant evidence to show that shortly after the second charge was filed, they wanted to get rid of Henry. And that allows for an inference of retaliation. And Henry Davis was an employee who had been with the company since 96. He received great reviews in 97, 98, 99. And then, after his second charge is filed, and after this instruction to his supervisors to find a way to get rid of him, Henry starts to get written up for things that were nonsense. He gets written up for having a hairnet on when it something that he'd been doing continuously before, had never been told that it was a violation of any rules, and there were no rules. he gets written up for some excess grease on the dock where he worked, which was something that was within the scope of duty to do and clean up. He was never told about this. No one ever brought it to his attention. And no one, his immediate supervisor at least, had never even seen evidence of this problem. So things changed for Henry after his second complaint. Then in July of 2000, at home office, they start to refer to Henry as a problem child. And that's in an email that circulates to Conway and is seen by many of Henry's supervisors. And in November, he's referred to as a problem person by the president of the company. And so you can begin to see that the evidence shows that there was a building case against Henry after his second charge. Now, I'm well aware that the court has often stated that the temporal relationship alone isn't enough. But we don't have a single discrete instance months and months away and then something happening after that. We have a series of events that are all consistent with the retaliatory motive occurring in a relatively short time after a second charge, and I think that's significant. Another point of evidence that I think that the court ignored below or I think mistreated was who made the decision to terminate Henry. Henry was terminated in December of 2000. In interrogatory answers early on in the case, it was stated that the termination occurred at the hands of Mr. Pence and Mr. Patrick. That's consistent with the response to the charge of discrimination. And it's significant because Pence is the person who said, find a way to get rid of Henry. In the motion for summary judgment, the defendants had filed affidavits from a Mr. Keck and a Mr. Hartman saying that that decision was not made by Mr. Pence or Mr. Patrick. And the court below chose to believe that evidence, even though it was contradicted by prior interrogatory answers. And I think who made the decision is a jury question. And it's important because if it was a person who had a motive to get rid of Henry, who had an effect on that, then it's evidence that justifies the case going to the jury.
Well, what about the pretext issue, though, with the economic right sizing? Because it seems that there was a consistent policy to eliminate a certain number of people and whatever, and one can dispute this, but it seems to be consistent throughout the company.
I think
he just got one of the people who was designated and his job was eliminated.
Well, the first reason to question how important the economics were is that 11 people were let go. Seven of those people were called back, including two or three that had less seniority, more pay, and in job positions that Henry Davis was qualified for.
Was that in job positions that he was doing before?
One of the job positions that he was doing was on the dock supervisor, and the company claimed that, well, that was a position of one or a category of one. But Henry was qualified to do, and the evidence showed that he was qualified to also do maintenance on the dock. And two of the positions that were refilled shortly after they let everyone go involved jobs that Henry was qualified to do. And they gave those jobs to people with less seniority and at a higher pay than Henry had. And they were people that had not filed prior claims of discrimination, and they were people who were not African American. So if we didn't have that set of circumstances, then I think the employer's case is stronger on their economic reasons for letting Henry go.
They didn't put anybody in the position he held, though, did they?
Well,
it didn't exist, and then they created it, he took it, and then when he left it, nobody filled it again.
Well, I think that's a matter of convenience, and the viewpoint that we have, and I think that's why this is a case that should go to the jury, is that the employer can can do that in order to put itself in a better position to withstand litigation. And then the question really is, what was the real reason? Why didn't they call him back? And Mr. Patrick, according to the testimony, told Henry Davis when they let him go in December, you will not be called back. I see I'm running out of time.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Ware.
Good morning, counsel. May I please the court. Let's put this in perspective. This is a single plaintiff race discrimination case. Appellant's counsel was arguing this morning is the same thing that they've done throughout the litigation, which is there's no evidence of race discrimination. And so what the plaintiffs have really done is he said, I'm upset because I was terminated as a part of an economic cutback that affected 55 people, including the plaintiff. But there's no evidence, they don't even proffer any evidence, that it was due to his race. This is a race case. With respect to the failure to rehire, they don't have a failure to rehire claim because that was not a part of the EEOC charges that they filed. So that matter has been waived or abandoned. The district court did not err in dismissing their discharge claim because the plaintiff failed to show that the basis of his termination was the impermissible reliance on his race. They have no evidence of that, none whatsoever. Mr. Keck, the person that appellant's counsel referred to as writing an email about him being a problem child, was not deposed. Had they deposed Mr. Keck and asked him why he used that term, he would have told them what he said in his declaration, which is plaintiff failed and refused to sign his review. They argued about it for 2 weeks. He finally signed his review, and Keck said, we got a problem person out here. He won't sign his review. This reliance on old charges, as the court's well aware, is impermissible. Those charges, one, are outside the statute, and two, the plaintiff failed to file a lawsuit after having received the right to sue letters on two occasions. So those claims are abandoned. So what do we have? What we have, in essence, is a litigant who, because he was let go, decides that because he's African American, that he's going to file a lawsuit and claim it was due to race. But the courts have consistently held just saying it doesn't get you past the threshold. And let's look at a couple of cases. I think they're instructive in the context of what the plaintiff has talked about in this case. In Rush versus McDonald's Corporation, Seventh Circuit case, the court held that racial discrimination with respect to discharge, as that term indicates, requires more than evidence that the plaintiff's employment was terminated. Just because you're black or in some other protected class and you lose your job, that doesn't mean it was discriminatory. Court held, the plaintiff must show that the basis for the termination was the impermissible consideration of race. That is, that a person of another race would not also have been discharged under similar circumstances. Let's look at that for a moment. In our case, at the South Bend plant, 9 people were let go. One was Asian, one was Hispanic, one was African American, and the remainder were Caucasian. So the plaintiff cannot demonstrate that a person of a similar race would not have been let go under similar circumstances, because they were all let go under the same circumstances. Next, the plaintiff tries to use this sort of pretzel-like analysis to show that he's got some evidence of discrimination by talking about basically 3 incidents. This name-calling incident between he and another coworker, one, did not involve someone in a position to discipline and or terminate plaintiff, and two, plaintiff was also involved in some back and forth. So you don't have any evidence at all, any direct evidence of his race. Nobody referred to his race. Nobody used any racial epithets. No one said anything to him or did anything to him that would indicate it was race-based. In the Adams case, the court held that the plaintiff must show, either through direct or circumstantial evidence, that the employer's decision to take the adverse job action was motivated by an impermissible purpose, such as his race. And this court has recently held, in the Bertelli case, that even if you find that someone, an employee, for example, made an offensive comment, if that employee is not the decision maker, then that's not sufficient evidence to survive summary judgment. So again, what the plaintiff has here is a complaint because he got terminated, but he doesn't give this court, or didn't give the court below, any reason to suggest that that was because Conway was motivated somehow by race. There is no dispute that there was an economic downturn in the business following September 11, 2000. It's undisputed. What the plaintiff did, or the appellant did, was to say, well, if you read the report from the home office, it looks like they were making a profit, but they weren't making a profit at South Bend. As the court pointed out earlier, the plaintiff's position didn't even exist. It was created just for him. When the downsizing occurred, his position, along with many others, were determined not to be essential.
So these other jobs, there were callbacks. He claims that some were called back. I assume those are types of jobs that were, there were a number of people in those positions, and they just had fewer of them, and then called them back, like truck drivers and things? Is that?
Yes, sir, and dock workers.
Because with this job that he held, Mr. Davis held, was that just, was that the only job of that kind?
It was, yes, sir. It was a non-essential job.
In he started out part-time, then there was some dispute about whether it should have been full-time, they made it full-time.
As a matter of
and
fact...
And eliminated it. Is that the process?
I apologize for interrupting. As a matter of fact, when the initial notion came up the chain to create this job, Mr. Grima said, I don't think it's necessary. And he was persuaded by the line fellow down there, let's just go ahead and do it. So they have created it, but they've eliminated the job not only in South Bend, but throughout the company. It's not because of Mr. Davis, just the job is not essential. And I also add, Your Honor, that Mr. Davis does not have a failure to rehire claim. That's not what his claim is. He doesn't claim that he was discriminated against on the basis of going to be rehired. His claim is that he was discriminated against because he was terminated.
And well, so he's talking about retaliation. I think that's the issue of the termination at that point, wasn't it?
Well, I think with respect to retaliation, again, I think the plaintiff has some of the same problems. One, the plaintiff's claim that the retaliation was because he filed earlier charges. The district court found correctly that all of that evidence is outside the statute, and it is. But even if you consider it, which it should not be considered, but even if you consider it, it still is no evidence of discrimination. What you have are an isolated incident between he and a coworker. That coworker had nothing to do with his termination. You have a comment made by Keck, which they allege is racially motivated. I don't know how you get racial motivation from problem child. They didn't depose Keck because if they had, he would have told them. He was referring to the fact that he wouldn't sign his evaluation. With respect to this alleged comment made by Pence, the only person that heard that was the plaintiff. Get rid of the plaintiff. But he didn't say get rid of the plaintiff because he's black. He just says, if he said it, which we doubt, we need to get rid of the plaintiff. I'll interrupt you.
Well, I guess it's just that the retaliation part is for having filed a claim, a complaint. It doesn't even matter what the issue was, or it does. It was the so-called retaliation for filing it. He says that was why they were referring to him as problem child. That seems to be a amorphous term. Different people see it for different reasons. That you say there's some place in the record where it actually says that that's because he wouldn't sign his, whatever you call it, review?
Yes, sir. So Mr. Keck's declaration. They didn't depose Keck. He's the one who used that term. And he, in his declaration, he indicated that he was talking about the fact that he wouldn't sign his review.
So you're saying that's because they didn't counter it as an undisputed fact?
Well, that and the fact that Mr. Keck also said, Your Honor, that he was not even aware that plaintiff had filed charges of discrimination. And Hartman, who's supposed to made a comment, wasn't even aware the plaintiff was African American. So to say, one, if you can even get to it, it's outside the statute. Even if you get to it, now you've got to bootstrap it up and infer that that's what they meant. And as you know, in this circuit, inference is not sufficient when you're talking about evidence of discrimination. The evidence has to stand on its own. The district court below was properly dismissed the plaintiff's claim, granted summary judgment for the appellee, and we'd ask this court to affirm that decision. Thank you very much.
Thank you to both counsel. The case is taken.